right. So I'm Nicole, she, her, hers. And I am so glad to be here today. For one thing, I've always wanted to come to a service here. I go to the Vista Congregation, Palomar Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and I didn't think that I would get to come for my first time sitting in this position, but I am so glad to be here. When I'm thinking about what to talk about, I usually choose something that's on my mind, and that's been something I'm either struggling with or something that is complex for me. So today's topic comes directly from the covenant that we have at POOF, which is what we call our congregation. Don't make fun. Okay. And what our covenant says, together we are more than we would ever be alone. Therefore, we promise to practice radical hospitality, mindful communication, and active stewardship. Thus do we covenant with each other. And I'm really grateful that our covenant says to practice, since the idea of mastering these concepts is a bit overwhelming. I'm focusing today specifically on mindful communication, perhaps because it is, for me, the most complex and necessary part of that covenant to focus on. As I was thinking about this and realizing how much harder this subject is than I anticipated, I was reminded of something that the Buddha said. Open your mouth only if what you are going to say is more beautiful than silence. That's a lot of pressure. My interest in words started when I was about one, and I've been using them ever since. My mother was an English teacher, and she introduced me to Away with Words on KPBS, and she loved to say, look it up in the dictionary. My mother passed a couple of years ago, so she did not have to endure the horror of watching my children sitting in their places saying, Alexa, how do you spell instant gratification? My mother taught me that words are powerful. They're our most powerful weapons. They're also our most powerful medicine. Words aren't finite or tangible, but rather symbols that can only exist in the context of history, culture, and identity. Words and symbols change with social paradigms. And as we're going to talk about today, social paradigms change with words. There's a story from long ago, and I'm sorry to say, I don't know the origins. One day a sage was walking on a long journey. As he was passing a village, a frantic woman ran to him and explained that there was a child in the village who was sick and needed help. The sage ran to the village with the woman. A group of villagers had gathered as they brought the child out to see the sage. And a man in the crowd said, as the sage began to pray over this child, said, how do you think your prayers can heal what medicine was not able to heal? And the sage said, you are a fool. The man became very angry. His face reddened. His muscles tensed. He clenched his fists and he started to walk toward the sage with his hand up. And as he approached, the sage gently put his hand on the man's shoulder. And he said, if one word could enrage you and turn you into an aggressive attacker, don't you think that other words might have the potential to heal? It isn't just stories that tell us that words are powerful. Research backs it up. I'm a fan of both sides of my brain. The first example of the influence of language is evident in an experiment aimed at the relationship, determining the relationship between intelligence and performance on problem-solving tasks. So the experimenter divided mice into two groups according to intelligence. And to simplify things, one group, the intelligent mice, were put in cages on one side of the room with the word smart on their cages. And the less intelligent mice were put on the other side of the room with the word dumb on their cages. So grad students every day came in, followed the protocol, did their thing, ran the mice through the mazes. And after hundreds of points of data were accumulated, it wasn't so surprising what the results were. Turns out the smarter mice figured out the maze quicker and gained more time than the less intelligent mice. No surprise until you find out that the mice were randomly assigned to the two groups. There was no difference in intelligence between these two groups. So how could this be? How is it that the labels of smart and dumb affected the mice even when the mice probably couldn't read the words? It turns out that without knowing it, the graduate students behaved differently with the mice with the label of smart compared to the mice with the label of dumb. They held the smart mice longer. They pet them more. They talked to them more. And these differences were enough to improve their performance. In this case, the words did not reflect a difference. They created a difference. I have my own story of the power of labels several years ago now, as many of you probably remember. When my wife and I were fighting for marriage equality, there were many people who tried to convince me that domestic partner means the same thing as spouse. And even if the legal protections were the same or that we were able to have all of the same benefits, stories of domestic partnering don't land in the psyche in the same place as stories of marriage and spouses. With all of those associations of meaning, the shared history, equal language invites us into seeing what unites us. This reminds me of Mary Hamilton. Mary Hamilton was a Black civil rights leader who was arrested for her involvement in a nonviolent protest in 1963. Mary Hamilton refused to answer the questions put forth by the prosecutor when he referred to her as Mary. You see, in 1963, while white people were referred to by honorifics, such as Mrs. and Mr. and Miss, with their last names, white people in authority often used terms like boy for Black men and girl for Black women, or would simply call them by their first names. Miss Hamilton did something that took a great deal of courage. She told the prosecutor, "I won't respond until you call me Miss Hamilton." Her case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and she won. The highest court decided that all people should be referred to in the same way in a court of law. They recognized that while honorifics, by no means can they on their own render a court fair and equal, they recognized that not having the same honorifics would almost guarantee that the courts would be unfair. For most of history, we have understood language to be something to use to communicate our thoughts, describe our experiences and observations. But we now understand that language goes a lot further than this. Language provides the framework for new ways of seeing. So here's an example that I think is just fascinating. A few years ago, this research came out. Some of you may already know about it. A graduate student studying ancient literature stumbled upon something very interesting in either the Iliad or the Odyssey. I get them confused because high school was a long time ago, but in one of those. And she came to see that in all of the colorful descriptions used in these works, that they had red seas, black skies, yellow flowers, but no mention of the color blue. So she searched through some other things and found that in all of the writing of that time, there was not a mention of the color blue. It we have not, our eyes have not changed in that short amount of time. So it was not a matter of not being able to see blue in the way that we do. So what was going on? As the graduate student researched further, it was discovered that in most languages throughout history, blue is the last color to be identified. We start with black and white, and then red, and then yellow, and then green, and lastly blue. It was theorized that this is due to the scarcity of the color blue in nature. And I know everybody says, what about the sky? They actually looked at that too and found that people, until they are taught sky, see the sky as an empty expanse and not as a thing in and of itself. Again, the power of a language holding a concept. Egyptians were the first to use the word blue and also the first to make blue dye. So the most amazing part of this is that if we do not have the word blue, we don't see blue. This was demonstrated with an isolated Nambian tribe. The tribal language contains several words for green, but no words for blue. When shown a page covered with 11 squares that are green and one that is blue, members of this tribe were unable to identify which square was different than the others. Likewise, when a sheet was covered with 11 squares of one kind of green that was named in the tribe and one square of a different type of green, people like me and you and people who were not members of that tribe were unable to recognize the square that was different. That's pretty trippy. Without a word, the 12 squares appear the same. You can look at this online, by the way, and look at the squares and blow your own mind by going, you don't see the difference. This is a powerful indicator of the importance of language, not just as a form of communication, but as a bridge between ideas, a builder of concepts, and a refiner of perception. Since learning the story of blue, I often reflect on what else I might not see. Not because it does not exist, but because it has not been named. When I was in elementary school, I was taught by teachers and read books that talked about congressmen and firemen and chairmen. And I never felt like they were talking about me. Despite being informed many times that the masculine language was meant to be all-inclusive, my gut didn't agree. And I was told again and again to ignore my gut. They told me I should feel included rather than asking me if I did feel included. So what does this tell us about mindful communication? Our fellowship does have a description of mindful communication, and I'll read it to you. We foster healthy relationships through honest, responsible, and direct communication, valuing humor and joy. We express ourselves and set our boundaries with love and kindness while presuming one another's good intentions. We listen attentively, speak our truth with compassion, convey appreciation, practice forgiveness, and welcome ourselves and others back into covenant. This is not bad, and it tells us what we are meant to do, but it doesn't really tell us how to do that. In order to be able to fulfill that covenant, there is something that's required, and that is self-awareness. Mindful communication requires self-awareness, including an awareness of the undeniable fact that we are limited in our perspectives. The lenses through which we look are created by our experiences. These experiences not only impact what we notice, but how we interpret and make meaning of the events around us. There's a Brazilian saying that I like. It says, the head thinks based on where the feet are planted. Being mindful means not speaking with certainty about experiences that are not ours. Rather than telling people how they should feel, ask them how they do feel. Listen with children's ears. Speak only what is true, remembering that our truth is limited by what we cannot perceive and have not yet experienced. When looking at a sheet with 12 green squares, my truth was that they all appeared the same to me. I can express that truth as my own without mistaking it for the truth. By making this distinction, which is what we do when we are able to be mindful, practicing, not perfection, we create space that allows others to reflect on their own experiences rather than having to defend the right to have them. Ludwig Born reminds us, getting rid of a delusion makes us wiser than getting hold of a truth. Mindful communication involves humility and vulnerability because it involves maintaining a stance of not knowing. It means that we wait for meaning rather than jumping in with our own assumptions and judgments. The biggest killer of curiosity is thinking we know something. Once we come to an answer, we narrow our vision to seek confirmation. Our conclusions close the window on greater understanding. This is, I think, an anonymous quote because I was never able to attach it with a name, but it says, taste your words before you spit them out. I've also come up with an alternative for that. Taste your words before you tweet them out. Rumi, he's my Sufi boy crush from the year 800. He says, yesterday I was clever, so I wanted to change the world. Today I am wise, so I am changing myself. So some of you might have hoped that I would come up here and give you the answers to mindful communication. But that wouldn't be very mindful. We listen to what other people have to say, and we run them through our own unique and beautiful filters to understand on a personal level what messages mean to us. And I invite you all to take time to ponder your own messages, your own ways of becoming mindful communicators and mindful listeners. Now, I always try to stick with the covenant that we have at our congregation of appreciating humor. So I have a little UU joke. I got this from the Toronto UU congregation's website. How many UUs does it take to change a light bulb? We choose not to make a statement, either in favor of or against the need for a light bulb. However, if you, in your own journey, have found that the light bulbs work for you, that is wonderful. You're invited to write a poem or compose a modern dance about your personal relationship with the light bulb, presented at next month's light bulb service, in which we will explore a number of light bulb traditions, including incandescent, fluorescent, three-way, LED, tinted, all of which are equally valid paths to luminescence. Thank you very much for having me here today.